Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will speak about the recent BRICS summit, its enlargement, and we will reflect on the overall consequences for international economics and geopolitics. Joining me for this conversation is Lord Jim O'Neill, who has been coined the actually BRIC acronym more than 20 years ago, back in 2001. Hi, Jim. I'm well honored to speak about this topic with you. Welcome to The Sound of Economics. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a great honor and pleasure.
And I'm also happy to have our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero, joining this conversation. Hi, Alicia.
Hello, Giuseppe. How are you doing?
Very good. So, from the 22nd to the 24th of August, the 15th annual BRICS summit took place in Johannesburg in South Africa, attended by the heads of state or heads of governments of the five member states: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The headline announcement of the summit has been the biggest expansion in history, as Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates were invited to join. The enlargement, as well as the other announcement of the intention to put in motion to diversify monetary transactions in the global south from the predominance of the US dollar, has been commented primarily in the geopolitical context, including China's drive to remake the group into a counterweight to the G7, Russia's defiance of the West in the context of the Ukraine war, and so on. And there are a lot of things we would like to unpack around that. But before going into such analysis, I would like to ask Jim to remind all of us what he had in mind when he first used the BRIC, without the S, acronym, back in the days in 2001, and how that compares with the actual political grouping that is shaping up today.
Well, thank you, and it's a good place to start, not least because so many people who I see write or talk about it clearly have never read the first paper I wrote. Because it's often suggested it was some kind of marketing investment idea or trying to recommend the establishment of a BRICS political group. And it was neither of those two things. In fact, linked to the broader aspects of what you've touched on, and no doubt we'll discuss more, it was pretty clear to me, and remember these were in the days and weeks and months after the horrors of 9/11, that we needed to have a different kind of global governance system than the Western-predominated one that had effectively persisted since World War II without little change and recognition of the changing nature of the world economy. So the very original paper was indeed proposing that something like the G7 should be expanded. And remember, at the time, it had become the G8 because Russia, we all loved Russia in those days, to include certainly China and possibly India and Brazil. And crucially, in order to make it not too unworldly, and with it being just a year after the start of the euro, I controversially also suggested that the eurozone should be represented by one entity and not individually by France, Germany, and Italy.
So something more similar to what happened to become the G20 later on.
Yes. So if I reflect back over the 22 years and the way the world has evolved, sadly, the really positive thing that did happen, it now feels briefly, was the resurrection of what was a sleeping entity, the G20, in response to the 2008 financial crisis, which of course includes all the existing G7 countries, but crucially brought in all the BRICS and interestingly and importantly, perhaps in the context of who the BRICS have expanded to include or not, other really important emerging economies, such as Indonesia. And to me, that was, and in another piece I've just published for a major Chinese magazine, and still is, a much more legitimate body that represents something like 80% of global GDP, which neither the G7 nor the BRICS, whether they're expanded or not, do.
So what happened instead was something a little bit different, right? I mean, it has become some sort of political grouping which is separated.
Not at all clear to me that they've achieved anything other than starting off the development bank beyond really powerful symbolism, because it is a constant reminder that the global south, which they're the most important members of, feel underrepresented in global governance. And I think they're right. But this idea that they're some kind of counterweight to the G7 is clearly there in many of the heads of important BRICS countries, including the Chinese. But it doesn't make any sense, because it's not as though the G7 really does anything either. And so I can easily get myself quite depressed that we seem to be in this sort of rather silly battle between the G7 and the BRICS or BRICS Plus, when neither are capable of dealing with truly global issues. And I sort of fantasize that one day in the near future, we will get some kind of lead. Here's an idea for a Bruegel paper. Why not get the most important European figures to say to China and India, why don't we resurrect the importance of the G20 and we will stop attending the G7? So the G7 will cease to exist. And implicit in that is that the BRICS guys stop this idea of some kind of alternative political grouping, because it doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
Alisa, what do you think about this proposal and on the overall analysis that we just heard?
So basically, Jim, your idea is that all of this, you know, bunch of European countries basically flooding the G7 should just go there united with one voice, if I hear you correctly. By the way, we have more than the member states, if you recall. The Commission participates.
Yeah.
The European Central Bank. So basically we are, what, 4+2, 6, you know, 6 out of 9. And you're saying, and rightly so, that probably our economic power does not justify all of these people. And that, you know, I think if we had a more cohesive G7 with a single European representative, and then Canada and Japan and the US, and then your point would be, let's invite those that really matter in the global south. So to start, India, also the UK and China. So basically, you know, we kind of cut at the UK level, put it this way. And then we have this group. That's your idea. And that would have been a great idea 10 years ago, maybe.
Well, that was my idea.
Yes. So your idea was great when you thought about it. And the problem is, do you think, and this is just a response in a way to your proposal, that this can work today?
Well, I don't think it can work today with the current mindsets of the US leaders, or for that matter, the opposition, and nor for the way China's currently probably thinking. But as we've seen in the past decade, you know, things can change pretty quickly. And I don't think it would have been impossible if somebody closer to the mentality of an Obama was still running the United States. And I imagine in the future that could happen again. So I don't think it's something that could never happen, because it is just so obvious. And when you look at the economics of it, by the end of this decade, there's a very strong likelihood India will be at least as big as Germany or Japan, probably bigger. And notwithstanding China's enormous challenges, which, as an aside, I do think they're probably the biggest I can recall since ever following China, but without a severe crisis, China's going to be close to being as big as the US, if not bigger. How can we have a world governance system where these guys aren't at the table simply because we don't like the way they run themselves, and we all think we just like the way we run ourselves in the West. Even though, if you really get specific, and where I have even more sympathy with the mindset of some of the BRICS countries, you know, Japan and Italy, to take two G7 countries, have effectively shown no nominal GDP growth for 20 years. So why do we kid ourselves that these guys are important countries to be in the center of global governance when these other places aren't? It's just, and going to what you started off with, Giuseppe, in a way, it kind of justifies why the global South gets too hung up on this sort of somewhat misplaced symbolism, because they look at it and think, well, this is just ridiculous, which it is.
To echo what Alicia has been saying, and reading also in what you are saying now about the relative weight of other states of the G7, I mean, you mentioned Italy, for instance. So, I mean, even just purely in economic terms, it's clear that the G7 is dominated by the USA. And then if you go and look at the BRICS, it's clearly dominated by China when it comes to the... Just purely I'm speaking about the economic side. But to a certain extent, this kind of proposes or like reinforces what we've been reading in the news, that this is some sort of simplified vision of the potential use of both groupings as one other proxy of the China-US rivalry, which we can, of course, wish to be overcome anytime for different reasons, which are valid. But as we know, this is something that for the moment is a fixture in what we are seeing in international politics. And can we say something more about the role of China in this announced expansion and what should be read into it?
The way I would put this is that 10 years ago, for me, China had a regional hegemony objective. And that would have probably fit with hesitance, obviously, from the US, but still fit within the framework of a potential new G7, let's call it whatever number, with part of a global South and part of those members, as you said, you know, in a more constrained way for the Europeans. And that's all fine. But the minute that China changes, and I think that's Xi Jinping's basically China dream, in my view, the part of the China dream that is never like spelled out, but clearly there, in my view, the minute that China wants to become a global hegemon, that idea of having a grouping that reflects, you know, the kind of the balance between the South and the West or the developed world can't work anymore, because the objectives are conflicting. So it is not coincidental, or I don't think it's because of the Europeans being reluctant to give up power that we are here. The US would have, to put it very bluntly, kicked us off if needed. If the US had agreed or had envisaged that world where there would have been a division of power that would have still fit the US interest. But the problem is that China was not ready to reduce its dream towards a regional one, and clearly probably understood maybe this is the global financial crisis in my view, and beyond, with the arrival of President Xi, that the only way out for China was to achieve global hegemony, not only regional hegemony. For me, that's when the break Jim O'Neill's dream, to put it differently, starts cracking, because Xi Jinping's dream does not fit the reality of your dream, Jim. And that's basically, in essence, I don't think it's only a US story. It's also a China story.
Very interesting to hear you say. You know, I'm not sure I fully go along with that interpretation, but I get why it could be exactly right. And there's two or three nuances to why I say that. First of all, just on the US side, I think the US has often liked and still likes having different European countries in the room, because it knows it can then easily find differences of opinion between them. So, you know, I the idea that the US would ever want one single voice from Europe, I'm not sure that holds up to a lot of evidence, but maybe. But to the more substantive part of what we're discussing, there are two reasons why I'm not sure I really go along with that. First of all, is I don't really believe that the Chinese treat the BRICS topic at that great importance. I had the honor of hosting arguably the most experienced Chinese international ministerial diplomat at an event at Chatham House in June. And I tried to be as candid as possible. He's a very, very experienced person by the standards of people like that I've met from China. And I didn't detect that the expansion of the BRICS was some major thing for China. I don't think it's a major policy priority. I think it's just a very convenient sort of enjoyable game that allows them to say they're the boss of the global South and to keep putting forward this agenda, which challenges the mindset of the West and the US. And I'm not sure they really mean anything much beyond that. And secondly, arguably of more substance, inside the BRICS, unlike the G7, we've got India, which whilst it's economically 5-6 times smaller than China still, India sees itself separately as a champion of the global South, as you guys I'm sure know, and they're not just going to ever do just what China wants. And so that's partly why the BRICS will never really function until those guys can really agree on something. But it also means it's difficult for China to push all these guys around.
May also have a little comment on that. To the complexity of the global South, I mean, that we are saying. I mean, there is definitely what Alicia is trying to point out. The role of China is definitely there, and the China dream. But there is also some sort of agency from other big actors in the BRICS groupings that don't necessarily want to play just along with China. I mean, just along with China. I mean, I don't mean that they might not playing along with China at the moment, but they also have agendas which are specifics for their own regional blocs or etc. You know, and I think this is where the analysis of what is going on after the summit would be interesting. And what I've seen less into the commentaries that have been produced in the days after the summit is exactly to delve a little bit more into the potential of this more complexity at play and what can mean for global economics. For example, I would have liked to read more about what Dilma Rousseff, the former president of Brazil and the head of the BRICS Development Bank, had to say during the summit about the future of local currencies, which has been quite a lot something that has been stressed during the summer. And the role of the new development bank is likely to be crucial to foster cooperation among those states in BRICS. And the bank's aim is that 30% of what they lend is in local and digital currencies and with no condition attached, unlike the IMF and the World Bank. So what would happen if this is actually going to be successful? I can only think about some of the questions, like about exchange rates between the BRICS trading partners and between trading blocs if trade is increasingly settled by virtual currencies. How would current account disequilibria be inside the BRICS bloc translate into their bilateral exchange rates based on fiat money? And how would it affect their bilateral exchange rates towards the US dollar? I mean, would like to go a little bit beyond the headline and trying to see in the fine grain of this what could change in the world economic system. And I'm thinking that the use of digital currencies is something that's completely new and is something that if they push forward and they could be doing it ahead of the US and the G7 countries, that might change a little bit the game.
in many ways, the only really systematic monetary system-wide thing to think about is the role of the yuan or the RMB. And that boils down to the same thing as always, as to how quickly the Chinese want to take some risk to allow it to be traded more freely where they can't control things that might go wrong. And in my opinion, the Chinese have been very slow, but probably quite sensible about that because of what they observed about the Asian crisis in 97-98. But they are the only one, because of the size of their trade, where this currency issue, I think, is really that interesting. Secondly, it is technically really intriguing about the digital currency stuff. And it could be very important for some of the smaller countries. And I think you're right that it would be taking them ahead of some Western countries. But in terms of, you know, big issues about foreign exchange policies and all the rest of it, I don't really see any of those, unless I'm misreading it, significantly, you know, being of great relevance. Thirdly, however, in the events of China and India really, really sitting down and discussing what could we make this BRICS thing become and what is it we could really do together, you know, then you're talking a whole different ballgame. Because, you know, even though India is a lot smaller than China currently, it's growing very quickly and it's getting a lot bigger very quickly. And their border is huge and they can do so much trade together. And some of the BRICS stuff I did with my colleagues years ago, we showed that it would, if they were really serious, these guys alone could transform global trade. But linked to some of the things we touched on earlier, they're often not very serious. And going back to the sorts of things that Lula has been saying, who, from my experience, is a pretty savvy person, a lot of what he's been saying publicly is just for sort of symbolism. I mean, the whole idea of a BRICS currency is just completely bananas, you know, and he knows that. But I think it really boils down to when and how, if at all, the Chinese want to accelerate the pace of RMB reform myself.
So I think that we are going towards the end of these episodes because we don't have so much time. And in order to conclude, I just want to have a snappy reply from both of you in order to close this conversation. Do you think that we need to take BRICS seriously after all?
I'm going to contradict myself. Yes, because of who are in the BRICS, in particular China and India. No, because if they were going to expand for really sensible reasons, Indonesia would be the first country to bring in next, and they would have had Nigeria from Africa ahead of anybody else.
Alicia?
The answer is yes, because the West has been denying this reality of the Global South for too long. So let's help the West by saying, yes, we should take BRICS seriously. But the composition of BRICS Plus now indicate that it's not only about global powers, because if not, as Jim said, it would be Indonesia, Nigeria. No, it's about the need. And there's two clear needs in that group. One is control of energy, brown energy, fossil fuels, very clearly, with a new composition. Secondly, need for funding. So I think what they want with Argentina, with Egypt, is to show that China can come to the rescue, that they don't need the West or the IMF for that matter, or the Bretton Woods institutions to help countries with financial balance of payments problems. And that's a big change in the global financial architecture. So these two things are important and perhaps explain why the group looks different than just bringing the largest countries.
Thank you. And of course, we will discuss for much longer about the topic, but this is all the time we have for this episode. And I would like to remind our listeners that, as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Alicia, Jim, thanks so much for joining this conversation. And thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you very much for having me, guys.
Thank you.